it's like, I think this is better. And it's hard for me to verbalize. I mean, I know why it's better, but verbalizing why this more expensive option is better is hard versus it's just better. How is it better? Well, how do I even explain this without like getting too technical? And then it's like it's just better. Just trust me, it's better.
Just pay more dollars because it's better. Yeah. You'd be great in sales. That those people are a dime a dozen, so
I'm a great salesman, trust me, bro.
Right.
It's better.
Source, trust me,
Yeah.
bro.
Oh, we're live.
Yeah. Pay attention to the clock. You'll learn something. So, you want to introduce this topic of yours, or are you just going to wait until somebody takes charge?
One of the two. We'll find out.
Yeah, you're welcome. So.
So it's kind of end of days, whatever that means. What does it mean? What do we think it's going to mean? We know a few things of the Dresdenverse of like, okay, so the big apocalyptic trilogy. We even know the titles of the books, and we know that Faith Astor is going to return and somehow kick it off. But what else can we draw from? And I saw something about what like Christian theology says about like end of days and how it got into the rapture type of movement, and it's just like it got, we got, maybe we have some details to schizophrenically speculate about.
We've never done that before, so this will be new for us. Yeah. So I guess, I mean, one of my first questions is, do you think that the rapture is actually going to happen in the Dresden Files?
I
Do you
don't think
think,
so.
yeah. I have a tough time believing that it would, or betting that it would, I guess, you know.
Yeah, I don't think that Jim would ever do something to take people out of disaster.
That's fair, you know. Like, yeah, I mean it depends on the theories and the ideology, right? Like, you know, in some cases it's like bunches of people, you know, you've got like millions of people, and that, you know, that's probably the evangelical take, is that, you know, the devout are everywhere, right? So they're just going to be beamed up, you know, in a skyship, learn to fly and shoot laser beams out of their eyes, or 100 other things. Or
First, like the first thing I thought when I was watching that video we were gonna watch there with the Left Behind and people getting beamed up was, there is no way that there are that many actual devout as that movie may get out. No,
that's
no way,
the
no how.
problem. Yeah, both the numbers that are usually cited from the Bible at various different verses, which don't often actually have anything to do with each other, mind you. So between the actual numbers that are usually cited from people that I've seen, and, you know, just knowing people in those circles anyway, and living in a state like that, you know, yeah, that's probably not going to be like, I mean, that'd be fantastic, but, you know, you've got to think, out of like a billion people, you know, who claim to be Christian and whatnot, that a good chunk of them would go. But, you know, I gotta say, probably in my estimation, not to cast stones or anything, but, you know, certain preachers that are on TV probably not making it, you know. So,
The devil's in the tomb, the demons. Have you ever seen that video? Why they need two TV preachers, why they need private airplanes?
oh
They
yeah,
can't fly
beast.
with the
Yeah,
demons.
yeah. I mean, that's cool, dude. If you've got like, you know, a salt encrusted outer shell on your airplane to keep the demons out or whatever, then, you know, more power to you. So,
Bless
none of
the wiper
those.
fluid, make it holy water, and so just spray
Sure.
it once in a
Yeah.
while.
Yeah. So, do you got the inside covered with Enochian sigils? Yeah, but
Have you been rewatching Supernatural?
no, but I remember, I thought it was both ridiculous and kind of cool when some of that stuff happened. And then when I was like, what's the root of this word? And I'm like, come on, you know. So, like, because if I remember right, Enoch was the guy who got beamed up first, theoretically. You know, it's just like when you're in Genesis and you're like, you know, this happened and then this happened and then this guy lived for this amount of time, and it starts looking like it's like 900 years, and then this guy only made it to like 400 or 500. And you're like, what happened there?
When
So,
talking about the Methuselah ages and all that, and the people living for like 800 moons or some fucking thing, you're talking about someone's age dropped
well,
dramatically.
I'm Yeah. Yeah. Well, so like, so it's Genesis, if I remember right, it's everybody's favorite part, which is, you know, Adam begot, and then they begot, and then they begot, and then they begot, and then they begot. And then in the middle somewhere, suddenly this guy didn't live very long. And, you know, literally the entire thing is so-and-so lived to this age, but he was, you know, something, he went to go know God directly, or, you know, I'm paraphrasing because it's been many, many years, but yeah, like the idea is he was translated directly by God was the phrase that came to mind. So, I don't remember 100% if it was Enoch, but you know, that was the guy that came to mind. So, but I'm sorry, guys, I blew up the director's brain and now she's doing ad hoc research.
Well, so. I happen to have a Bible right next to me. And so it's like, maybe I can actually find this.
Oh, so he was the father of Methuselah. So there's that, you know.
Okay.
Enoch walked faithfully with God for 300 years and had other sons and daughters. He lived 365 years, walked faithfully with God, and he was no more because God took him away. And it's like other translations use other language. And so
when Enoch lived the 65 years he fathered Methuselah, Enoch walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days Enoch were 365 years, Enoch walked with God. He was not, for God took him.
Right.
Okay.
And so it's just like, you know, like I want to say, you know, because Utah, that the Mormon take was like he got translated, which means, you know, God just basically said, hey, you're super righteous, we're just going to scoop you up and take you home. But, you know, like, because God took him, there's other translations or inferences to that, depending on, you know, the time and the culture and things like that. But I always had a problem with some of the early references to smiting anyways, that it was like, and then God smote him because he was an asshole. And it's like, I mean, are you sure he didn't just fall out of a tree? And then everyone stood around and said, that's what you get, you know? So anyway.
Oh, Septuagint had said, so the line Enoch walked with God and he was not found, says the footnote, for God took him. Right. So he went missing.
No.
He lost in transit, you know, from earth to heaven. It's a long way sometimes, a wind, and like Enoch's gone.
It's only 100 miles, really. You just, you know, when you can fly and shoot laser beams out of your eyes, it's not that far. So. See, I told you this topic would be great because we were going to derail it anyway. So you're welcome.
Didn't know this was going to be useful.
Yeah.
Keeping that around.
I don't know, might be the first time
this book has ever been useful in the history of ever.
That's not true. Some people use it to hold up monitors. So
right.
Sorry. I do believe and I do consider myself a Christian, but you know, sometimes you got to lampoon this stuff. So, but.
I don't.
Yeah.
As
get really weird, I still have a Book of Enoch right over there that I can actually just go grab.
Yeah, right.
As implied by my subtext.
Right.
Well, that was a huge diversion. Where were we going again? Welcome.
So, I made jokes about the Enochian sigils because the airplanes, but right, we were talking about like, do you think the rapture,
do we think that's going to happen? I truly don't think so, you know, because... Yeah. I really don't think it's in Jim's style.
Right. That's not what the author would do.
I don't think so. Yeah. Also, I find it interesting because I never really thought about Rapture much other than how the left behind pop culture, the older Jewish version of the tradition is that the people who remained are the ones that were saved by God, not the people who were taken. The people who got to live on to the millennial kingdom.
Through context clues, it kind of infers that. But then you also get the whole, like, maybe the rapture was just, picking them up and dumping them off in Jerusalem, you know, for example. Yeah. So
the rapture were just the friends we made along the way.
Yes. I mean, to Dresdenify this a little bit, like the whole, like, I'm not sure if this would happen. It's like, so you have literal Knights of the Cross who are literally carrying around nails with angels imbued in them that have been, you know, imbued into these swords. Do those guys get raptured? Why or why not?
No, they have to fight.
Right.
Well,
right.
That's not how it works, right?
Like, my take would be that the... You know, whatever happens in the apocalyptic trilogy it's not gonna be the white god initiating anything or rapturing people against free will. Can he even take people away? Wouldn't that be breaking their free will?
If they could be given the choice.
Yeah, I mean, that's where your knights would get left behind. It's like, you can come with me and a bunch of people could die, or, you can go fight some more.
Crap, I don't remember exactly which document it was, but I will post that video in our description so everyone can look to it. What we were kind of schizotypically pulling from, but there's a description of their, Christ will take pity on people and he'll send from heaven his 64,000 angels, and they're basically going to war. Now upon those forehead, the name of Christ is written, and upon whose hand is the seal, both the small and the great will be taken up upon their wings and lifted from his wrath. So possibly 64,000 angels coming to gather people and take them away to some form of safety. These angels possibly being Gabriel and Uriel, and they make some form of pillar of light that allows people to be safe. This might be the transportation to the Holy Land that's just going to keep them safe while everything else is going to hell, literally.
But I'm just thinking, you know, even if we look at it in context of the Dresden verse, then the never-never, the angels, even the demons and Lucifer and the Denarians, they're all still Team Reality, and almost certainly the apocalyptic trilogy is going to be outsiders, full-on assaulting reality, the gate breaking down, something like that.
Right.
In which case, the devil would probably be on our side because he's in reality.
I know you're trying to say something, and so I'm sorry. And just to interject real quick, that's an interesting concept in the sense that it's like, maybe that's why the rapture wouldn't happen in the Dresden Files, because translating a bunch of people into heaven isn't going to save them from the outsiders, you know? So it's like, I mean, maybe he gets them out of the way so that they're safe, which, as the director has bet, that's not the author's style. People don't get to be safe in this book series, but maybe he doesn't bother because he knows that it wouldn't actually be any kind of safety anyway, you know?
Well, the other thought is that, so the more powerful anything is, the more restricted they're able to act in the Dresdenverse. But if something crosses the line, then they can try to rectify that balance. We've seen that multiple times, fairies, angels, demons, all of that. So if the threat of the outsiders actually penetrates in some way, it could allow more action of the white god and the archangels to do more significant things.
I mean, for the Dresden Files cosmology, basically, I'm assuming that, you know, if there are, you know, warrior angels and all of that stuff, which, you know, it seems like Uriel knew how to fight, so probably is a good bet. Their first job was to drive out the outsiders. And so, yeah, like, I imagine when the outsiders break through the gates, the gloves come off. Right.
It's, you know, like, it is interesting, though, if you think about it, the outsiders do get involved in the politics between, for better, heaven and hell, and the protection of free will, and how they try, and how the Denarians and stuff, and how they're trying to affect free will. How I believe it was all but confirmed it's Lashiel that somehow gets the whisper of doubt to Dresden, right?
Right.
Which then Uriel is allowed to balance.
Right.
Have we seen any of the more powerful beings beyond, you know, Winter and the gates? Have we seen any angels at any time interact with outsider plots or shenanigans?
Well, do we count Mac?
Do we count Ghost Story?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so because the whole trial that Dresden went through with Ghost Story, remembering everything, and he remembered He Who Walked Behind and all that, prepared him for facing whatever's through that door, and all of that was set up by Uriel. So it's like, that's kind of tangential, but it was definitely preparing Dresden for more outsider things.
Yeah, the reason why I'm like trying to, and I'm fine with preparing Dresden, is I think it's hard to put 64,000 angels and Uriel and all these archangels and stuff into a direct like, he can undo galaxies, put him into a direct conflict with the outsiders, and still have Dresden matter storytelling wise in the story.
Right.
He's not, I mean, Harry's going to get more powerful in each book. He's not going to get as powerful as Uriel.
Right. Well, and I mean, you're along the same lines that I was thinking, because I mean, Ferivax can't fight the Titan because he will literally rend the fabric of reality and the surface of the earth because he's so powerful. So how do we have a clash?
You could just do a little thing.
Yeah, which still helps. It's going to have to, anything that happens there is going to happen at the gates, or it's going to have to happen at the Never Never somewhere, because the earth literally couldn't survive it in the rules that have been suggested so far. Right. You know, so
the mothers can't really get involved even.
Yeah.
We cannot get higher than Map and Titania. Really. I think Battleground is a good indicator for about how high we can get with people participating without making Harry irrelevant. Even some of those entities that actively participated in that fight were way more powerful than right. Harry. But well, he still mattered.
I was going to say, like, I think that's going to be your litmus test, right? You know, is that you're going to have another battleground style of fighting where everybody's going to be locked in some kind of stalemate, or they're going to be countered or something like that. And then Harry's going to be the guy that slaps the button, or he's got to make the decision, or he's
the fulcrum. So they're going to be fighting to get him into position to be the fulcrum.
And the fulcrum is a what now?
That's what we don't. This is actually going to be a
lot. No. I'm not. This isn't cute. I'm not saying in Dresden Files, what's a fulcrum? The word fulcrum, it's a point of balance, right? He's the decider. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm saying the angels and the outsiders and everybody else are going to be locked in, and either something's going to get through that he's going to have to deal with, or he's got to make the penultimate decision, right? That kicks everything off. So that's what I'm saying, is like, Andreas is right. He's going to be so freaking outclassed. Like, unless in book 18, he becomes an archangel somehow, he's going to be way outside of his weight class, you know? And so that's what it literally means to be a fulcrum. So without other information, that's what I'm saying, is that, he's either going to have to fight a skirmish that's still outside of his weight class, but only he can handle, or, you know, because that's in the author's style, right? The Shoggoth gets through, or whatever, that he's got to defend the orphanage against, or, you know, he's got to make some pivotal decision, because that's literally what fulcrum means, you know? So
it's a lot easier. It would be a lot easier for us to speculate after the next book or the book after that, once we finally get to know
we'll
exactly.
Turn to this topic, I assure you.
By the end of Mirror Mirror, we'll of course have all the questions.
No, but when we have more Starborn details, what that actually
you hope feels,
right?
Then hopefully it will be easier. Yeah,
theoretically. Theoretically, we're to the answering stage of the book series, right? Where, you know, going into the BAT, hopefully there aren't too many more questions that need to be answered, you know. But
yeah, I'm listening to book 8 right now, which is the one where Molly gets introduced as his apprentice and the Phobophages and all that.
Proven guilty,
And there are still questions from this book that we don't have answers.
There's a lot. Proven Guilty actually added a lot of questions.
Yeah.
And we haven't answered them. Like, Proven Guilty is where the van hit happens.
Right. The Chrysler that runs
Little Chicago. Like the people in the garden. There's a lot in Proven Guilty that still hasn't been revisited, let alone answered. Yeah,
and I would say that's another point where an angel was interacting with outsiders, because Michael went to protect the baby wardens and they were being attacked by outsiders. And Uriel surely was involved in making sure that someone is there to protect Molly.
Yep. I don't hate it, but
that's been my theory ever since knowing who Uriel was. Like, the first time reading through the whole series of just like, okay, he was there. And he was doing things to make sure that the Harkonnen family is intact.
Yeah.
Molly is protected. The baby wardens are protected.
Right. Screw the time travel book. That's what we need, is we need a book from Uriel's perspective, where it's like, here's all the times I had my hand on the scale, you know.
That would be
just fun. A little bit, you know, just a little bit. So
yeah, it's like the warrior, but more of it.
Yeah, and then even better, have it written from the perspective of like he's getting yelled at by Harry in the church, you know, and it's one of those flashes where it's like, and there I am fixing little Chicago, and there I am still getting yelled at by Harry Dresden, and there I am, you know, making sure Molly doesn't die and, you know, whatever. And it's just like, because
he wanted to send me a bill.
He's, yeah, right. He's extra dimensional and, you know, he's existing at all points in time, theoretically, in all the multiverse.
Uriel is the ultimate cat's paw. So he's never actually doing the thing until he lets Michael borrow the jumbo jet. But he just makes sure other people are in position to do those things. He knows how to place the fulcrums. And so it's going to be, it's going to, I think it would be more like the warrior of like, Uriel gives some form of hint to Harry of you need to be right here. And then Harry follows his nature and yells at someone, smartasses at someone, and protects a little girl somewhere.
Right. You'd think somebody as volatile as Harry would be harder to predict. And yet, you know,
no.
Uriel, Marcone, and a dozen other people really count on it. They're like, you know, it's tea time. And wouldn't you know it? He's about to blow his lid and warm up my tea for me because he's so freaking predictable. Yeah. So, yeah.
Like whatever argument Mab was having with Ebenezer at the top of the tower in Battlegrounds is just, it's like, and you people blame me for manipulating him. So something's happening there.
I thought you were going to quote the other one, like, yes, you defy me. Like, can we just skip to the end? So yes.
Reference something incomprehensible. We'll just go on. It's like, we agree. So what if those 64,000 angels aren't actually angels, but there's some form of like anti-denarians?
The opposite of denarians. We have a word for that rookie. They're called angels.
Like, the opposite of denarians.
Yeah.
That's non-fallen angels.
Right. Well, right. Like, so taking the description.
They still have their wings and, you
know. Well, it says like they have the name of Christ is written upon the forehead and the hand is the seal. Yeah. It's like, well, the denarians, they have those little sigils on their heads.
Sure.
And so what if you had more of them that are just like that, but, you know, on the opposite side, whether the angels or not, whether the angels have been given to attach to someone, but like it's a person wielding this amount of power and this is what they're going to look like,
you know, like, because those are your choices, right? Because what you've got to like acknowledge is that the reason why the denarians are the way that they are, or the knights are the way that they are, is because of the restriction of power, right? And so the denarians are bound into coins because, you know, because of what Judas did, right? So there isn't going to be an equal and opposite measure there. The knights are the counter for the denarians, but those were three nails because of the crucifixion. But yeah, if you're thinking there's some like shadow force for light on the other side, like it's going to be Uriel and his pals. Like, you know, maybe Uriel has a fallen angel hunting squad, you know, that you'll see or something like that. But in my estimation, those would just be angels, because if they're restricted, they're going to be bound to an artifact. That's how we've seen them every single time so far, except for Mac, because Mac doesn't have his power. But if they have their power and they can, you know, utilize it or something, you know, I got to imagine they're going to be in weapons or other similar kinds of artifacts, you know.
Bone of a saint or something.
I wouldn't, yeah, not like that, but I mean just like, yeah, like a holy censer being used as a flail. I don't know, I can't get off the weapon kick right now. So it's like, you know, they're going to be in gladiuses because that was the style at the time, or they're going to be in spears, or they're going to be in, you know, swords like Michael's, and, you know, so on. But you know, maybe you'll see a holy bow. I don't know. Do you have baby, you got the cherubs in the arrowhead? That's what it is, you know, so a little bit of Uno reverse there. So
It's a really good point that it's going to have to be attached to some form of artifact, at least following the schema as we've seen so far.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, with the BAT, I got to imagine they're just like off the hook at that point, you know, some way, somehow the gloves come off, you know.
That's right. And so it's like, maybe that's when the rules are going to break and no longer needing to be attached to an artifact or something. But I don't know. Which one's the trumpeter?
I want to say it's Gabriel or it's Raphael, but yeah. Raphael. No, wait.
Okay.
Hold on. Sorry. It is Gabriel. Sorry, the top thing threw me for a loop. So
Google lied?
No, it just, it was like the SS Raphael and Gabriel something something. And it was like, I think it's Gabriel. So,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got to say, just to get it out of my system right now, that like the more we talk about this, the more convinced I am that Mac is Michael for some reason. So, but we
had, well, Sonya said that he spoke to Michael and received the sword.
How long's Mac been out?
Longer than Sonya's been alive.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty strong argument, but you know. But it's like Mac had to be somebody important, right? Like, I mean, yes. he could have been an angel, but like the outsiders have come directly to, you know, harass him. So I don't think he was just an angel. So yeah, like he's either something else new, or you know, perhaps, you know, like less prominent. You know, kind of like Uriel usually is, or you know. Yeah, so.
Assuming that Michael, the Archangel, is still active, I guess I do kind of wonder, what has he been up to other than giving a sword to Sonya? That's pretty much all we've known. Because did they name the Archangels that are in the nails in the swords?
I don't think they're named in the books.
Right.
You know, presumably they have them, but... Yeah. Yeah. And if the names of the swords didn't change, like I would submit that maybe the name of the swords reflects the name of the angel, right? But
can you tie those up to each other?
Like Fidlockius and
right. So fidelity, know. Hope, and love, but right. Which angels correlate with that?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah.
More research needed.
Right. Oh boy, the Catholics are going to love me today. So,
some more details of this theology of what the apocalypse might look like. There's a description that trees will be uprooted and topple over, wild beasts and farm animals will die in a catastrophe, birds will fall from the sky to the ground. It's kind of basic of just that could be every kind of disaster, catastrophe, bad weather event. But something, if I'm going to go really schizo with this, which I'm going to, this seems like it's attacking, well, obviously it's attacking like the world of nature, but I feel like it's also attacking fairies and the Never Never and the fairy connection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's important to know that Rapture is almost always tied up with Revelations, and Revelations gets a whole lot more specific with shit like that, right? Because that's when you have the whole, you know, the blood turns, or the moon turns to blood, a third of the rivers and the oceans and the water all turns to blood. And, you know, again, like I try to reframe this for myself through like an older lens, right? You know, that it's like, you can come at this with your modern sensibilities, but I got to imagine that this book wasn't written for you because it's been a real long time since it was written and all of this other stuff. Right. And so it's like, when you're also talking about the amount of wars that are happening and stuff like that, I was like, does the water literally just transmute into blood, or just the water is choked by the blood of thousands and thousands of fallen soldiers, you know? So, which is totally not reinforced by my recent reading of, you know, Cursor's Fury. So just saying. Hey, that book series is like, what, 20 years old? The moratorium on spoilers. I like, he needs to read it. So I'm going to be gentle with them, but some things are going to slip out. So, yeah.
Right. As it could be something very, pragmatic like that, of just all the people dying could be choking up the rivers, or it could be like that scene in The Mummy when everyone's drinking bourbon and then all of a sudden it's blood. Yeah, but the connection of the Fae to nature has been present for thousands of years in the folklore of like the Fae live undergrounds, or that's like the, you know, trees, water, sprites, whatever. They are intimately connected to both reality in that way and Never Never. So is this a valid way of actually attacking the fairy, of like, destroying the nature that they might be tied to? If you,
I think it's chicken the egg. I think the reason why the birds and everything gets chaos is because somebody attacked fairy, you know, like not they're attacking nature to get at fairy. They attacked fairy and then nature got thrown out of balance would be my take anyway. So
this might be a symptom. If they break down the gates and they're attacking through the Never Never, there might be repercussions in reality, in nature, as the beings that are tied to it in the Never Never are being damaged. Some form of symbiosis that's being damaged or corrupted.
I mean, what? So like, other than getting a just you lose response from what happens when the gates come down and the outsiders come in, right? You lose. You know, like what would the intervening time look like, right? You know, yeah, like does Mab continue to throw her forces at the gates to stem the tide? Because if you don't hold that, you hold nothing. Does Titania throw in with their lot, in which case nature is unrestrained and chaotic and all of that stuff, right?
So, right. So the yearly cycle balance that they have to do might be disrupted if both of them are removed from reality and no longer switching off that way. Then all of weather, all of nature might be completely in flux.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, after the point of if they break down the gates, then what happens? Because before the just end game and you lose, the rapture evangelism seems to describe that there is going to be 7 years of the reign of the Antichrist. So maybe we can take that as a hint that there's going to be 7 years during this BAT to try to save hopefully do it. Seven is a number that shows up a lot in Dresden Files. And so that means it's important.
Or maybe the BAT is going to be 7 books.
Okay.
No, just kidding. Sorry. Because it's, you know, trilogy being the T word there, but.
Andreas, you're muted. There you go.
Why am I muted? I didn't press that button.
No, I don't know.
The whole, it's just the Antichrist and all that, the things that are set up Christianity-wise is just not very consistent with how it's built up in the Dresden verse.
Yeah, I think the Dresden verse apocalypse is going to be inspired by, you know, the following things, but you know, it's going to be its own thing, right? You know, so
because otherwise, I was thinking maybe what's her name, who's going to kick off the BAT,
Faith Astor,
coming with her newborn son, the Antichrist. But why would that make sense? Because the Antichrist would still be on Team Reality.
Spoilers. It's going to make sense because Jim watched those movies when he was small and influential. So you got what it was, prophecy, and you've got, you know, like all those related, you know, movies. Obviously there were multiple prophecy movies, right? So, but yeah, just saying, it's totally how it's going to go.
Yeah. Okay.
Not at all.
See, I expect the person who's going to hold themselves up as being the Antichrist is going to be Nicodemus.
Could be. So, but I think Revelations is a bit more specific about that too, actually. But if we suddenly start Nicodemus taking an interest in politics, I'll change my answer. So,
well, yeah. I think he cares about politics enough to be able to want to,
I mean, like,
make use of it. Yeah, if he's going to start running for president or whatever.
Right.
Wasn't that part of the plot of The Left Behind? I don't know. I didn't ever pay attention to it, but a friend when I was a kid was like watching it nearby. Just like, what was happening? I'm confused.
Yeah. I'm not super familiar. I think my mom read all of the books and then like the show came out and I was just like, yeah. Weirdly, considering like I've read Revelations a few times and like super up into most of the apocalypse stuff, stayed a mile away from the Left Behind stuff because it just seemed too off the wall. Like they get credit for having done some research and trying to weave that into the books, I think. But yeah, other than that, I was just like not interested to read them. So but.
But seriously, I think Nicodemus is gonna do something with some form of this, especially because it is some form of pop culture power that he can manipulate, just like he was trying to manipulate with like starting a plague and that all death and despair and whatever in death masks. Then he can make use of this type of reinforcement to his own power by being the Christ antichrist figure for people going into battle of the BAT, whatever. I figured in some fashion that's part of his plan, or he will at least monopolize on it.
Yeah, that still assumes that Nicodemus isn't off wallowing somewhere, or you know, come back to, you know, team up with Dresden in some fashion in book 20, because you know, like those are more along the lines of my theories than that Nick is running around still being a huge pain in the ass. Like, granted, we don't know what he's doing with you know, the artifact that he got and all of that stuff, but you know, like his power base got hammered in multiple ways. Like, he's not just going to be like, ah, yes, well, we're going to springboard from this giant freaking defeat into an even bigger success. Like, I don't really see that happening, but I could be wrong. So,
well, yeah, he's either going to stay essentially an underdog now, or he's going to have to become more powerful, more scary. We just don't know which one yet. We assume that he's going to be scary somehow because he's been an antagonist. He's still an antagonist, even though he's got the hints that still Team Reality.
Right.
That's kind of like the implication as well through conversations with Dresden throughout the books, right? That it's hinted at that Nicodemus believes he's on the side of Team Reality and doing things that are necessary. For yet undisclosed why, like we don't know exactly what his thinking is, but firmly set against the outsiders in some way is the implication. At least that's the implication that I get from it, that he thinks he's doing evil things for the greater good.
Right.
Yeah. Because he wants to survive through it to the end and probably be in a good position there.
I mean, we've talked about all the nuances of his lines before and everything like that, but you know, I think his best outcome is all of the humans are dead, and then he dances to that song from Flight of the Conchords. But then also, you know, even if he dies in the process, as long as he gets his job done, then sainthood, because that's one of the requirements of sainthood. So you know,
Saint Nicodemus.
Maybe someday.
Right. See, I guess that it does become a question of like, doesn't Nicodemus care about other people surviving? What does he care about? I mean, now that he's lost his daughter, it's like, what is the thing that he might be trying to save?
Reality. Like, reality was more important than even his daughter. Come on, he Thanos'd that shit. That was textbook Thanos play.
I don't know. I guess we just need to see him again, see what that his state of mind is and his more of his reasonings and motivations, because in the vacuum since Skin Game, I guess we've overanalyzed it.
I think originally it was The apocalyptic trilogy was going to fall on book 20, which would be a Denarian book. Well, that's not really the case anymore.
Well, it would have been 21, 22, 23, because we would have had a Denarian book to end case the files. Case with. Yeah. Right. Yep. So we would have had some
sense. Yeah, it would have made sense for Nicodemus to trigger the apocalypse and then, you know, the BAT handling the fallout for that. That was a really strong theory until he started adding one and then two and then three more books. You know,
But also kind of countermanded by the implications that unless Nicodemus accidentally triggers the apocalypse, but at least he thinks he's trying to stop the big apocalypse from the outsiders is kind of the implication.
Right. Yeah.
How that makes exactly sense with, for example, what he originally does in book five, whether that was Kim had not that planned out yet, or I don't know.
Oh, because I think
beyond book five, it makes more sense. But with book five and what he's trying to do there, it makes less sense.
What? Nicodemus has always been working towards end game, as he just started describing in Small Favor. But it could be he doesn't know how far away in the future end game actually takes place. It's been taking place over the course of, 16 years or so in the books. But what are the calculations that anyone is using for how fast it's going to happen? So he could believe that as of Death Masks, that it's going to happen within the next year. And so he needs to be as powerful as possible right then.
Yeah, me. Does he actually? I think he says that, right? Like, this is the end game or something, isn't it? Like,
he says that in Small Favor. So he didn't say that in Death Mask, but he thinks that he's playing right at the end. And so everything needs to be as powerful as he can right then. Or with his lifespan, that could seem like a very short time.
Yeah, true. Like, that's also relative to who's talking, right? This is the end game. Right. That could still be 50, 100 years. That's the end game because he's lived for over 2,000 years.
Right. True. So Matt brings up, you know, talking about a specific the enemy. So I just think he's talking about, you know, the white god was kind of my first assumption, but maybe the outsiders, you know, or something like that. But
kind of seems more likely with the hints that's dropped, right? But yeah, Nicodemus and his motivations are unclear, to say the least.
Well, yeah, they're murky because we're coming at it from our perspective and a sane perspective. Mm-hmm. Like he's almost got blue green morality, right? Where, you know, his moral compass doesn't align to what we would normally be used to. And I mean, you could argue that's Anduriel's doing, right? Because Anduriel has opened his eyes to whatever. Like, angels don't think about, you know, they shouldn't anyway, theoretically, think about, you know, morality and everything the same way as we do.
Even time, like Lashiel says to Dresden, he would have to die to be able to understand time better.
Right.
Because time is like essentially an illusion, she says. We also don't know the Denarians, the Rift, Hell, Lucifer. What that rift, that could be very much, if anyone's played World of Warcraft, there's a fallen titan who's like their gods essentially, and the reason he's fallen is he believes they must do everything necessary in order to beat a certain enemy. So he's the devil in World of Warcraft, but really the reason he's the devil is he's willing to go further to make sure they can fight this enemy, in this case, in the Dresdenverse, Lucifer fell, the Denarians fell, all this, the whole Hell faction, is because Lucifer was like, no, we gotta do more to fight the outsiders, and God was like, no, free will.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that is also a bit of speculation. It's probably decent speculation, but we don't really have confirmation of that from the Dresdenverse, of that's being the cause.
Yeah, we don't know.
Right, but it does put someone like Lucifer, Nicodemus, on basically in the same pathway as Mab. She steals children and puts them in a war. They're likely to die and suffer. But what better option is there? She's open to ideas, and those costs, as bad as they are worth it for the saving of everything else. And that's the way that Nicodemus seems to view it. He is causing death and destruction and despair, but that means that he is in a better position to fight against the enemy, and that's worth it to him. And if he's believing that he's doing it for the right reasons, Jim likes to play with that theme a lot, that means he's even more dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jim has talked about this just in terms of pure making stories on a meta level, right? Like how, like the whole, that the villain is not the villain in his own story. And we definitely see how Nicodemus think about it. Where there's the conversation with Cowl. Cowl doesn't see himself as the bad guy, even though Cowl is, and that's also an interesting thing we haven't even brought up here in terms of the outsiders and the end of days and stuff. Where's the Black Council and Cowl, who works with outsiders and use outsiders? Where do they fall in this whole political schema? Like, there's so much that we just don't know. We're just guessing. And who they're working with at least indicates that Cowl is on team, not reality, potentially. But he doesn't believe. It doesn't seem like he believes he's a bad guy. Yeah. But how can you be on team non-reality and not think you're a bad guy?
Because the Black Council are useful idiots. That's the only way that you can reconcile the fact, like, their actions versus what's happening and what we understand of it, is that the Black Council doesn't know that what they're doing is going to, like, blow up the whole world. They think that they are going to get some Dark Hollow-like power, right? And they're going to be able to become mini-gods and wipe out the White Council. So, like, yeah, that's my opinion and estimation of what they're doing, is that they don't know what they're doing and what the ramifications are, you know, like, so, ultimately.
Maybe the idea that there will be something remaining when the outsiders take over, they might think that there's going to be some form of kingdom at the end. I'm just using the words that are relevant in my brain right now, but... which one was it? One of the outsiders said that, was it He Who Walks Before, maybe, of like, we will take this place again, like it will be ours again or something. So they may not want to fully destroy reality. They just want to change it to what they want it to be, which hard to understand what that would be, considering weird interdimensional craziness, literally incomprehensible stuff. But
for some definitions, though, it's destroyed. Like, you know.
What we know is destroyed. And simply, like, Komori wanted to take away the concept of death. She wanted to undo death. Right. That would be an undoing of the rules of this reality. And she still thinks that's a good thing. So she could, like, there's going to be something at the end. And it's going to be completely different. And she thinks that's good. It doesn't necessarily need to mean the complete non-existence.
It's, you know, the easiest interpretation that I have of the outsiders and the whole taking back reality is that they, like Justin says, is more along the lines of that they want to destroy reality, because whatever void they are in and whatever, like, is outside of reality where they are and where reality is placed in a metaphysical interdimensional sense, that used to be theirs. God came along and claimed it for reality and lock them out, and they don't want to destroy reality so that space will be theirs again. That at a bottom level, like easy to say term, right? So I don't think there would be anything after. Would be whatever is outside reality.
It's an order and chaos thing more probably, you know. The White God came and brought order from chaos, right? That's like original.
Yeah.
Genesis, you know, separated order from chaos, separated light from darkness, separated the water from the sky, you know, like those are the first days of Genesis types of actions, right? So like that's kind of where my take is. And so they don't want to, like, you know, come inside. They don't want to, you know, like, get in the garden or whatever and like, oh man, I can't wait to taste apples again or some nonsense, right?
They want to tear the garden down.
Uniform, yeah, they want uniform chaos. And so, you know, it could be a more primordial chaos like, you know, Azathoth would be, right? You know, if we're going to bring in more of the Cthulhu mythos.
How is that in Cthulhu?
You know, like... I think reality is something like a fever dream of Azathoth. So, you know, like it's kind of an accident and, you know, it will vanish at any moment in time. And, you know, what you know as Cthulhu is just the shadow that the true being that befits that name casts on the third dimension, you know, stuff like that. So it gets even weirder there if, you know, we want to go down that kind of
road, but Jim takes inspiration from a lot of folklore and other pop culture and stuff, right? Like, and there are heavy Lovecraftian elements, but I don't know how far he will take it into the weirdness, because it's nearly impossible from what I understand of the Lovecraftian stuff, and you're a way better expert than me, Justin. I've not read much. I've mostly seen videos about and things, but it's like attributing actual plans and meaning and thought process to what Lovecraftian creatures are is nearly impossible, because it's just they're just chaos. They're just they can't think like we do. That there is no line that we can follow that would make sense that they follow. Is that a fair assessment of it?
Yeah, I mean it. Right, like they're. First of all, we're inconsequential as human beings, right? You know, so that's the most important takeaway. But then, yeah, they don't necessarily even just have plans or machinations. People have plans, you know, they're just creatures. So, yeah, and I said blue-green morality earlier, but I think it's blue-orange is like the idea of like, it's just so alien to your perceptions that like, if they do have machinations, you couldn't understand them. So yeah, like the thought that came to mind while we're talking about this is that reality is literally a bubble in primordial chaos. And what kid doesn't want to pop a bubble? That's it. That's all it's got to be. They don't want everybody to suffer. You know, they don't care about all of that. Theoretically, I'm just spouting. But it's just like, you know, they want it to be the same as everything else. They want it to be like it always was for untold, you know, time, because there is no reckoning of time in the primordial chaos. So this little upstart rebel named the White God came and decided to make a bubble and has been fighting them off, you know, one way or another ever since. You know, so like that's kind of my estimation of it. I honestly, I'm not sure we're going to get that deep with it before the end. You know, like we might get a couple more puzzle pieces, but I don't expect to get actually an answer, you know, like maybe 20 years from now when, you know, the files are all done and, you know, Aeronaut's Windlass is all done, you know, the Cinder Spires, and he's on to some other new thing. It'll be like, hey, what was even the point of all that anyway? And somebody will get an answer in a convention. Who knows? But yeah, like...
Or maybe they're all connected and this is his Cosmere.
Right? Yeah.
He refused to answer that question when we got to ask him a couple years ago.
That was specifically with Aeronaut's Windlass being connected to some other story, right?
Like, yes, but he refused to answer if it was a slant world and said it's more fun if you don't know. Mm-hmm. But... Mm.
Is it, though? I mean... Yeah,
it's like, probably so he has more deniability of like, how dare you think I would do something like that, instead of like, yes, these people are absolutely connected and so are the cats,
right?
It's how you're describing it with like how now there's reality, it's in the way, it's not like it used to be, and the outsiders just keep attacking because it has to go away so the things can be the way. Maybe it hurts them, who knows, because it is upsetting their form of order to, well, actually chaos, but how things should be. So potentially it's painful for them, but at least the walkers which are the outsiders we have actually like spoken to. Everything else has mostly been mindless beasts. They have some understanding of reality, like a pretty good understanding of reality and who people are and how to manipulate people and all that, all those things. Like they're very underhanded cat's paw way, at least he who walks besides. Yes. He who walks before seems less so, but we don't really know. Maybe he is, but it's just, you know, they are way more connected to reality in some way, right? Is what makes them so special? How are they different?
They're the infiltrators. They, for some reason, have the ability to infiltrate, and therefore they need to be able to work within it.
Sure, that's also what I thought, but it's just with when every other outsider is the if we presumably think about the way Justin explained, which is a fair description. What makes like it's just if there's more to it than that, are they the leaders? Or do they answer to that higher being that connects all the other outsiders? Where I think it's hinted with those dogs that can go through corners. They were all connected to one mind.
Yeah. So, I mean, you get a couple more hints from the hounds, you know, and some other things as well, right? So the hounds were struggling because they hadn't figured out the rules of our reality yet, you know, was one of the things that Ebenezer talks about with the way that they were behaving. The knights / the walkers probably don't have that problem. I think the other keyword
they've been here for a long time and then seem very well versed in reality, yeah.
Presumably. And so like they're probably a bit more normalized. I mean, it would be interesting to be like, if they do win, do they have any place in whatever the outsiders want either? Because they're just a little bit too restricted now for total chaos. Who knows? But yeah, the fact that they're also knights, like I took it as, you know, like a one for one almost, that these are the counter to like the primary archangels, right? Usually only hear about the four archangels, obviously, when you get to Revelations and a few other places, you know, you get seven. I think the Apocrypha covers so many more, right? But for like the main canon, they usually focus on the four. And then, you know, around Revelations, you realize there's more. But you know,
usually like, four is in most pop culture the archangels,
right? So you got the four riders, you got the four, you know, walkers in this case.
Do you think there's another walker we don't know about?
Max said there was three, and we don't know Mac ever lied, because in Cold Days he put three bottles of beer on the table.
Sure.
So that's as close as we've gotten.
Where did I get the idea there was four of them then?
I don't know.
Yeah,
four horsemen.
Maybe, yeah, but yeah. So I mean, if there's only the three, then I mean, we've pretty much seen them, right? So,
yeah, Shark Face behind and before. No, what's his name?
Beside,
which apparently is the guy who possesses people. Was beside? Is he just possessing one? Is he possessing multiple? Is beside the reason that the fairies could act against their nature? Was beside the one inside the cat in Cold Days, and Shark Face was also there, so there was actually two walkers operating at that time?
Beside was in Justine by the time that Cold Days happened.
Yes.
And therefore,
but can he be in more than one person? Because otherwise there are two walkers who can possess and change the nature of people. And
well, Nemesis presumably is different, even though they're on the same side as the outsiders, as the walkers.
Nemesis is not a walker?
I think they're different agents.
Because I would think a Nemesis was a walker and would be the besides walker, and he can infect a certain amount of people.
Nemesis has a limit of how many people it can infect. Jim never confirmed the number, so we're guessing 13 because significant number patterns. But Nemesis isn't the same thing as a walker. Nemesis allows people to act against their nature.
Nemesis specifically talks like, oh, this was a useful vessel, et cetera, et cetera. It's more than just having letting them act against their nature. It can literally take
over. That one did, because it had to force through with Cat Sith, and it was not the same thing as being able to work in tandem with, say, Maeve. But Maeve was acting against her nature and was not possessed by a walker.
We think.
Or she was acting against her nature. She was a free agent of her own, which is the problem. But
yeah,
with the help of Nemesis, not by possession. She was just unleashed.
I mean, I lean towards Nemesis being he who walks besides this influence in some way, whether he can actually take over. That he was in, maybe he's mainly residing in Justine, or it is mainly residing in Justine. Or 13. Justine is one of its 13 puppets.
Yeah.
Right. It could be that Beside might be someone who orders Nemesis around, or has some further connection to the sense of being possessive of a body is a similarity between them. But he who walks beside is not the same thing as Nemesis.
I was going to say, like, that might be where I figured there was four, is that Nemesis was the fourth.
That is also an option, you know, but I would say that Nemesis is either one of the three walkers or an unknown fourth walker to Mech. And then there are four, which would make sense with Archangels and Hellrismen and the walkers of four. Maybe. But that's a very wild speculation where we don't really have anything to substantiate it, right?
We don't have much to substantiate anything anymore.
Just write the books already, my dude. This will be a whole lot easier to answer questions when we have the answers already.
Yes, it sure would.
Yep. It's a good quote.
Yep.
So, this is one schizo-fueled episode of who knows the fuck what, but that's what I do now. If I see something, like, it had the name Uriel in it, I'm going to make it connect. Therefore.
Is that what grabbed you for that video? You know, it's like, wait a minute, Uriel, Pillar of Light, I got this.
Pretty much. And then other small things. But the idea that of like 7 years in some form of reign of terror and tribulations, like, I'm sure I can force this to fit. Anytime Uriel's name comes up in the old stuff. Yeah. So.
Well, this has been an hour of end of days ramblings and mostly outsiders, but it was an interesting discussion, I feel like.
Yeah. If anyone decides to go get some theological degree, then like you can come back and describe more for us.
We know a guy, right? So
yeah, what about Jacob's brother? He was on here.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know how much he cares about end of days, but
surely he's more versed in theology than we are.
I would hope. I will give him the credit of that without questioning, but we can see. And that we've got some projects we're working on that I don't know if we're comfortable publicly opening saying it right now. So just stay tuned, and then next week maybe an Arnold thing. I don't know.
Who knows? It's primordial chaos.
Mysterious.
We could watch End of Days or Sixth Day to keep.
I actually watched End of Days recently. The Arnold one. It's not that bad, actually. It's better than I remembered, but not great.
I don't know if I've seen this one. I don't know. Maybe it needs to be on a list.